Or a cereal box.
That glass bottle. Next month, pickle jar?
That pop can? Back on the shelf in just 60 days.
Don't waste it, recycle it.
Because in Minneapolis, what goes around comes right back around.
What else should you recycle?
Search Minneapolis Recycling to learn more.
Fresh Air Community Radio is KFAI-FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, online and archived at kfai.org, the community's true voice.
Good afternoon and welcome to Mini Culture Presents. I'm Michael Whetstone, and today we are going to be continuing our theme, Mini Culture's Year in Review for 2025. It has been another award-winning banner year for KFEI and for Mini Culture. If you missed last week's Year in Review show, you can find it in the archives at kfei.org. Today we are going to begin airing the Mini Culture Podcast Season 9. The Mini Culture Podcast was the winner of Best Podcast at last year's MNSPJ Awards. This is the Minnesota Society of Professional Journalists, MNSPJ. I really do think that that is a remarkable accomplishment, and it is especially such a tremendous feat because there really is a lot of fantastic radio produced right here in Minnesota with some real behemoths on the media landscape. You know who I'm talking about. So honestly, it really is impressive that Mini Culture gets recognized at all in such an environment. Of course, you're not surprised because you're already tuned in here and know this little station as a beacon of passion, individuality, and creativity right here in the Twin Cities. I'm sure that's why you're listening. It's why I do too. It's why we're all here, this creative community. But when you're not in front of your radio, you can subscribe to the award-winning Mini Culture Podcast and enjoy it anywhere, anytime. You can also find it on their SoundCloud page, soundcloud.com/miniculture. In fact, I do suggest that you go back and give a listen to all 8 of their seasons. They're all out there waiting for you to enjoy. Plus, today, after episode 1 of season 9, stick around. In the second half of the show, we're going to be hearing some new Mini Culture stories about sound baths, sound journeys, choir walk with me, and Project Get Outdoors from Mini Culture producers Allison Young, Sheila Regan, and Angela Lundberg. But first, Mini Culture proudly presents the Mini Culture Podcast Season 9, Episode 1, Ghost of the Upper Mississippi River from producer Lydia Moran.
Welcome to Mini Culture, the podcast where we explore the people, stories, and cultural phenomena that make Minnesota, well, Minnesota. I'm your host, John Gibertatios. The section of the Mississippi River that flows between Minneapolis and St. Paul is peaceful, placid, almost like a lake. But it hasn't always been like that. Not so long ago, this section of the river was fast flowing and treacherous, and the danger of traveling upriver contributed to a fierce rivalry between Minneapolis and St. Paul. Producer Lydia Moran wanted to know more about how the river came to be this way. She started by inspecting a ghostly industrial ruin underneath the water's surface. This ruin is a clue to understanding how humans have contributed to the taming of the wild river and what the future of the river might look like.
In the Mississippi River, about a mile upstream from the Lake Street Marshall Avenue Bridge, sits an abandoned ruin. When water levels are high in spring and early summer, it's easy to miss unless you're paddling directly on top of it or avoiding its edges in a speedboat. But in the colder months, when the river is shallow, the industrial ruin emerges. 2 330-foot-long concrete slabs, like sidewalks floating parallel to the riverbank. The first is just several feet from the water's edge, the second about 80 feet further out. They are dotted with a dozen bronze posts, like rust-covered thumbs. This past summer, I guided public kayak tours on the Mississippi. We took groups of paddlers downriver through the Twin Cities. I was often assigned to a route that traversed the river's gorge between Bohemian Flats Park and St. Paul's Hidden Falls Regional Park. Midway through this particular route, we stopped to float among the cement slabs and rusty bollards of the sunken ruin, our boats scraping and bumping against it.
Does anyone have any guesses what this is that we're paddling over right now?
People make guesses as they peer down into the greenish-black water. Maybe it was a dock or an anchor for barges.
Tie-up barges, yes, but what else?
Eventually, I tell them what we're looking at. This is the site of the first lock and dam on the Mississippi River.
And I talk about it as kind of like a ghost, a sort of an apparition that emerges from the water.
That's Dr. Bruce Braun, professor of geography at the University of Minnesota.
And I think of ghosts as things that haunt us from the past, things that come from the past that are still present with us and that demand a kind of reckoning.
Completed in 1907, the Meeker Island Lock and Dam helped to submerge the whitewater rapids that once existed between St. Paul and Minneapolis. It made the stretch of the river between the two cities traversable by boat, thereby increasing Minneapolis's power as a young city. But in 1912, just 5 years after the Army Corps of Engineers completed its million-dollar construction, the Corps destroyed the lock and dam and walked away. The Wild River, that cut through Minneapolis in the mid-19th century, was hardly like the river we know today. About 10,000 years ago, St. Anthony Falls was located just east of where downtown St. Paul is now, 8.5 miles from their present-day location. As water eroded the riverbed, the falls moved upriver about 4 feet per year, carving the Mississippi's only gorge. Early colonists described the river running through this gorge as one continuous rapid, marked by large boulders and a dozen small islands. They reported pulling their boats upriver for hours, using ropes tied to trees. In late season, the water was waist high at its deepest point. You could hop boulders from one side of the river to the other without getting wet. Every spring, thousands of spawning fish migrated to the gorge to wait their turn to traverse St. Anthony Falls. Fast forward to the mid-19th century, and the gorge and its harrowing rapids are feeding a fierce rivalry between the young cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Like I say, Minneapolis is looking downstream and seeing steamboats come and go 1,000 times from St. Paul and only 50 times from Minneapolis.
That's Mississippi River historian John Anfinson. He says Minneapolis was desperate to suck boat traffic away from St. Paul to bring more commerce and visitors to Minneapolis. Minneapolis also wanted to claim the title of head of navigation on the Mississippi River and become the commercial bookend to New Orleans. But that just wasn't possible when riverboat captains didn't dare traverse the dangerous rapids up to Minneapolis. Of course, some boats did try to brave the rapids. In 1855, a steamboat called Fanny Harris nearly sunk in the gorge when one of its wing rudders dislodged after striking a rock, and the captains fled the wheel in fear. The boat was saved from splintering to pieces by two other pilots who stepped in and pushed it along. But word of the incident traveled and formed dark clouds of unease over the heads of many riverboat captains. In the mid-1850s, A territorial judge and businessman named Bradley Meeker proposed damming the river to improve navigation. He proposed building a dam near an island he owned along what is now East River Parkway. The project sparked controversy in the two cities, and advocates and opponents weren't always split down city lines. Shippers and civic boosters in Minneapolis were eager to make their city head of navigation and lower shipping rates, while flour millers at St. Anthony Falls were wary of the competition the dam might bring. In St. Paul, some believed the dam would bring hydropower to their city, while others feared losing the title of head of navigation. But then, the Civil War erupted. The country fell into an economic depression, and the Lock and Dam project went on hold. 4 months before the war ended, State Senator John Pillsbury decided to take over construction of a lock and dam at Meeker Island himself. He helped convince the Minnesota legislature to ask Congress for a 200,000-acre land grant of Minnesota forest. The money from the timber harvested on the land would fund the construction. Congress obliged, but gave the land to the state of Minnesota to decide on the builder instead. But 2 decades of political jousting later, a builder still hadn't been chosen. In January of that year, Minneapolis Mayor Eugene Wilson asserted, quote, "Every dollar's worth of property in the city would increase 20% the minute the dam was completed." In an interview with the Minneapolis Tribune, he complained that without a passable river, commercial interests in Minneapolis would be entirely at the mercy of the railroad barons. By the 1890s, groups in Minneapolis were hounding the federal government to build a lock and dam, and the state of Minnesota had not chosen a builder, but was refusing to return the land grant. Tired of playing referee to regional infighting, Congress authorized funding to the Army Corps of Engineers to build a lock and dam at Meeker Island in 1894. They also authorized funding for a second dam, confusingly called Lock and Dam No. 1, which is still in operation along present-day Ford Parkway. The two low dams would finally make Minneapolis the head of navigation on the Mississippi River, but they were built at a height incapable of producing the hydroelectric power some business leaders in Minneapolis were hell-bent on keeping from St. Paul. Only one dam would have been enough to improve navigation, but the Corps moved forward with both. Much of the reason for this is still shrouded in mystery. Years later, Army Corps District Engineer Major Francis Schunk hinted at the stubborn rivalry between St. Paul and Minneapolis and the murky backroom politics that led to the superfluous lock and dam. He wrote, "There is the city of St. Paul and there is the city of Minneapolis. Enough said. There are two locks." Over 50 years after businessman Bradley Meeker proposed building a lock and dam near his land, construction finally began. By this point, Meeker himself had been dead for more than 3 decades, and the river was well on its way to becoming the highly engineered body of water we know today. But Bruce Braun at the University of Minnesota points out that when Meeker first proposed damming the Wild River, he was doing so at a time when the Mississippi's life as an industrial highway was not written in stone.
In 1852, that was just 1 year after the treaty was signed with the Dakota that, in a sense, opened the west side of the river to settlement. And it was a full decade before the Dakota Uprising of 1862. And so I asked myself, you know, what made it possible that someone like Meeker was, and others, were imagining the river in a very different way, a very new way, at the same time as that river and surrounding areas are still very much part of Dakota life worlds. So it's this almost willful erasure, this way in which a different kind of world, a different way of relating to the river is being completely ignored and, in a sense, imagined to be passing away.
The truth is, Meeker wasn't solely interested in helping Minneapolis claim dominance over St. Paul. To some, Meeker and his associates' original proposal to build the lock and dam was a scheme to defraud the government, and a land grab. As Minneapolis businessman Henry Titus Wells put it in his memoirs, the original Meeker Dam proposal was first and foremost, quote, The attempt of a few selfish plunderers to seize upon 200,000 acres of the best pine lands of the state and hold them for speculation. Which is to say, the remaking of the Mississippi River Gorge into the Placid Highway, the one that threaded the agricultural landscapes of the upper Midwest with faraway markets, is inextricably bound with the land theft and genocide of indigenous people throughout Minnesota.
And so, what is the reckoning that the Meeker Dam requires of us today? What does it mean to, like, reflect on this dam, its history, its provenance, and think about the kind of violent erasures that were possible at that moment, such that the river could be imagined as something that we take for granted now, that it simply is that river, it is that settler river.
In spring of 1907, the first steamboat passed through the newly completed Meeker Island Lock and Dam. In total, the Corps spent over $1 million, the equivalent of $37 million today, constructing the Meeker Dam and Lock and Dam No. 1.
So it's amazing to think that the Corps of Engineers builds this lock and dam, and only 3 years later, Congress authorizes abandoning it.
That's right. In 1910, Congress directed the Corps to destroy Meeker Island Lock and Dam just 3 years after it was completed.
What would happen today if the Corps of Engineers built a big lock and dam and said, oh, we're going to get rid of that now 3 years later? It'd be all over the news. It would be, you know, touted as a real debacle.
At the turn of the 20th century, long-distance electrical transmission became possible for the first time, allowing dams to transmit their hydropower further away from rivers. At the same time, the frontier was gone. Westward expansion had reached its limit, and Americans began to realize that natural resources were finite, sparking the conservation movement. President Teddy Roosevelt advocated that rivers should have multiple uses beyond navigation, one of those uses being the generation of electricity.
And so those events all happen about the time that the Meeker Island Lock and Dam is authorized and being built. So it just gets bypassed by the evolution of hydroelectricity in America. And people start realizing, wow, we missed a major opportunity in the Twin Cities for hydroelectric power.
Ironically, boosters in Minneapolis and St. Paul set aside their differences to lobby Congress for the construction of one high dam to replace the two low ones. In 1910, Congress directed the Corps to raise Lock and Dam No. 1 from 13.3 feet to over 30 feet, a height that was capable of producing hydropower. In the process, the brand new Meeker Dam was submerged, where it remains today. The Minneapolis Tribune did not report a public outcry at the project's restructuring. In a 1911 article under the headline, Big Lake Created, the paper heralded the high dam's creation of a, quote, lake which in area will be about as large as Lake Calhoun and Lake of the Isles together, capable of backdropping picturesque boating outings and the University of Minnesota's row team. The plumbing of the gorge also sparked real estate ads touting new lakefront-esque property along the soon-to-be-serene waterway. But the increase in riverfront property value proved to be a mirage when floating islands of sewage backed up behind the new high dam. The slowly flowing river became a stinking, typhoid-ridden pool of water, until about 1933, when the city built its first wastewater treatment plant. By 1963, two more dams had been constructed upriver at Lower and Upper St. Anthony Falls to form a stairway of water that carried barges up to the ports of North Minneapolis. But Minneapolis's dreams of commercial navigation on the river were ultimately short-lived. By 2000, only two barges a day came through the upper Mississippi locks, partly because agricultural transport was moved to the Minnesota River. In 2014, Congress directed the closing of Upper St. Anthony Falls Lock and Dam. The Corps of Engineers is currently in the midst of another study to determine if it is worth the cost to continue maintaining the two that remain open, only now for the occasional fishing boat, river cruise, or kayak tour group. One possible option they are researching is removing those two dams altogether and returning the river to its wildness.
So I got interested in this project many years ago, really just as a community member.
That's Dr. Rupali Fadke, professor of environmental studies at McAllister College. She became aware of the core study after attending a public hearing about it with some of her students.
We were just listening to how the core was trying to defend its project and its process, and I saw the level of interest and animosity that was coming from the public, and I remember thinking, this is fascinating, what's going on here in my backyard. And it's this topic that I've studied all over the world, and to see it sort of playing out in my own community. There's not a lot of examples of dam removal in an urban corridor like this, so it's pretty precedent setting.
Dr. Fadke received funding from the National Science Foundation to advise the Corps on how to engage public opinion on the future of Lock and Dam No. 1 and Lower St. Anthony Falls Lock and Dam.
How do we think about a future river without the locks and dams? It's really, really difficult if it's not in our living memory. And so engaging communities and thinking about what is their relationship to the river now? What do they want the future river to be and to do and for whom? It's a really challenging question.
Through surveys, interviews, and focus groups, Dr. Fadke and her team were able to engage over 400 people. They found that those in favor believed that removing the dams would improve access to the river, which could encourage new forms of recreation and tourism. But overwhelmingly, those in favor understood the main benefit to be improving the river's ecosystem. From a 1963 study, we know that over 123 species of fish were once in the gorge. Studies that took place between 1980 and 2022 found 27 species in total, and some of those were in numbers less than five. If fish were able to freely migrate without the dams, the river's resilience against invasive species such as Asian carp.
But I do always caution people that rivers are living things and you can't just turn back the clock and every minute the river is something different. There will be a pretty impressive degree of social and geoengineering that it will take to restore the river. We will be building channels. We will be building islands. We will be channelizing it in ways that maybe represent the historical flows, but it's not going to return to its, you know, pre-1900s look and feel.
Dr. Braun at the University of Minnesota agrees.
There's no original river to recover. That's gone. And so now it's a question of, you know, whose futures are embodied in the river that we invent.
Dr. Fadke's team also heard from people who were opposed to the idea of dam removal. Some were concerned with the level of toxic sediment that has been built up behind the dams and would have to be accounted for if they were removed. Others were worried about the potential financial costs of dam removal to the public. And as the planet continues to warm, bringing unpredictable precipitation events, it may be in our best interest to have control over the river's water levels. But realistically, the prospect of dam removal is a distant one. The study that the Corps is currently undertaking won't be available for public comment for at least another year, and after that, there will likely be a long back and forth about whether the Corps sells the infrastructure, and to whom, and if those parties even have the right or ability to remove the locks and dams. That might take up to 10 years. But Dr. Fadke wants the public to stay engaged throughout the process. As part of their public engagement work, Dr. Fadke's team set up postcard writing stations at locations across the Twin Cities. They asked people to answer the question, "What is your wish for the river?"
I would love to walk along the banks and pick berries. Or, you know, can the river help me pass my SAT test? Or, you know, so there's just this wide and lovely and, again, like, curious selection of wishes that people had. I want the fish to be able to thrive. I want the water to be clean. I want to be able to swim in the river. There were also postcards that said, it's really important to me that the river be, you know, let's say, quote unquote, returned to Native communities, or that Native communities, tribal communities, will steward what happens next to the river. When I think about what a healthy river is, it's one that's in relationship with the people that live around it. we know that climate anxiety is a huge issue. What would it mean to be able to access the river and have those sort of moments of wild nature? It might afford a really different kind of resilience.
Last summer, after stopping at Meeker Dam ruins, we head downriver to descend 30 feet in Lochan Dam number 1.
Doors are closing.
This dam still generates hydroelectricity. It once powered a Ford manufacturing plant. Now, a Canadian energy corporation owns the site and sells the relatively small amount of power it generates back to the grid. After the doors open, we wind past the mouth of Minnehaha Creek.
Yep. And we're gonna stay to the right when we get out. Yep.
Now that we're out of the gorge, the headwind has subsided and the current moves a bit quicker, pulling us along. In the distance, the river is bending towards a journey that is still yet ahead. For KFAI, I'm Lydia Moran.
This episode was written and produced by Lydia Moran. Kaylin Keir provided audio mixing support. Special thanks to Paddle Bridge Kayak Tours. Mini Culture is a production of KFAI Fresh Air Community Radio in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Support for Mini Culture is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. This podcast is edited and executive produced by Julie Sinsula. More episodes are coming soon, so make sure you're subscribed to Mini Culture wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your host, John Gibertatios. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to Mini Culture Presents here on KFAI. My name is Michael Whetstone, and that was episode 1 of season 9, Ghost of the Upper Mississippi River. Be sure to tune in next week for episode 2, The Long Dark Shadow of Minnesota's Eugenic Sterilization Program, from producer Matthew Schneeman. Or, if you subscribe to the Mini Culture Podcast, wherever you dig listening to those sorts of things, there are also 8 more great seasons for you to enjoy and catch up on. You can stay on top of everything these talented producers are doing at Mini Culture's SoundCloud page, soundcloud.com. You'll find buckets of terrific arts, history, and culture stories about our great state there on the SoundCloud page. And you can easily share them and send them to your friends and family from there. I just shared the story about the invention of bag handles to my own father. And if you would like to help keep these very vital and hyper local Minnesota-centric stories on the air, consider making a pledge to Mini Culture's radio home, KFAI, which relies on your financial support. This is real community, truly people-powered public radio. Please make a difference and a donation today at kfai.org. Thank you. You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul, radio without boundaries. Support for this program comes from KFAI listener members, just like you. Support for Mini Culture is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Stick around after the break. We'll be hearing new Mini Culture stories. Stay with us.
Support for KFAI comes from the Sear Culture Center, presenting Arkansas and the Chicken Wire Empire Sunday, February 15th. Progressive Newgrass Quartet, Arkansas Channel's Ozark Mountain Melodies, has a tour with their latest release, OK to Wonder. Wisconsin-based Chicken Wire Empire brings their two light songs to their latest release, Growing Pains. More information about Arkansas and Chicken Wire Empire is available at thecedar.org.
Despertemos, despertemos humanidad. Ya no hay tiempo.
Make the fight for freedom every day, in the year, every year.
We must not let ourselves be divided. Tuesday, January 27th is Active Voice on KFAI, a day of special programming spotlighting Minnesotans working toward justice in our current world. Learn more at kfai.org/activevoice.
Is it time to give your classic car a classic send-off? Honor your car's legacy by donating it to KFAI. Maybe your car isn't technically a classic, but you still want to give it a purpose. Well, we can turn any great ride into a great donation. We accept all kinds of vehicles, from used cars and trucks to RVs and boats. For more information, call us at 855-277-2346 or visit us online at kfai.careasy.org.
Welcome back. You are listening to Mini Culture Presents. I'm Michael Whetstone. With all the chaos in the world right now, a sound bath can offer a wonderful, calming escape. Sound baths and journeys are meditative practices that employ resonant instruments like singing bowls, gongs, and chimes to create a vibrant, pulsating experience and offer a unique pathway to calm, connection, and relaxation. In recent years, sound baths have been turning up around Minnesota. KFAI's arts reporter, Sheila Regan, went to check it out.
When you take a sound bath, sound becomes something you not only hear, but feel. Essentially, a sound bath is an immersive experience. Participants often lie down as sounds relax their body and mind, encouraging mindfulness and at times a trance-like state. At my first sound bath, I felt my body resonate in ways I'd never experienced before. Lying down on cushions set up at photographer Shelley Mossman's studio, I listened to the voice of Josh Sunby, Mossman's husband, as he guided us on a journey through space.
With your eyes closed, start to visualize in your mind a golden light.
The sounds of chimes, singing bowls, a gong, rain sticks, and triangles washed over me. I fell asleep eventually during the hour-long experience, but it wasn't just a regular nap. I felt like I left my body behind. Recently, it seems sound baths are everywhere in Minnesota and beyond. Mossman and Sunby caught the sound bath wave back in 2019 on a trip to Coachella when they visited a famous dome built in the 1950s meant to facilitate time travel. Called the Integratron, it was created by UFOologist George Van Tassel and is now operated as a sound bath.
It's got quite a history on how it was built and the acoustics and how precise everything in that building is for sound.
This was a really cool experience. It was really grounding and centering. It felt like it was something that we could do in our space.
Since then, they've visited a number of sound baths and began experimenting with hosting their own, inviting friends over to experience it.
It was basically like, hey, check out these sound bowls, mm-hmm. and just kind of listen and see how you feel. Tune into this experience and see what the frequencies do in your body. Be present and allow yourself to feel whatever comes up and just be part of that frequency kind of moving through the space and through your body.
Eventually, they began to host sound baths formally in their space in a series called Interstellar. They often invite collaborators like musician Reed Kruger to join them.
I play the singing bowls, and Shelley and Josh are taking different instruments out amongst the sound bathers.
I think sound baths really, really can put artists in a place of perfect intuitiveness. And it's just my happy place. It's very present, it's very in the moment, and it's very intuitive. I'm on cloud nine when I'm in that headspace.
There are as many different types of sound baths as there are people hosting them, and each person's experience is a little bit different.
I found sound back in 2012.
Kimberly Grogan sought out sound as a form of healing after she was diagnosed with Ramsey-Hunt syndrome, a rare complication of shingles that affects the brain.
It caused a lot of nerve damage on the left side of my brain. I had severe pain. I'm a really positive, happy person, but I actually considered not wanting to live because of that, because it was so bad.
She bought singing bowls and essentially taught herself how to use them.
I just love it. I just love it, and it just provides so much inner peace and healing for myself.
She eventually began to partner with places around Duluth to share her practice, including Halcyon House, which hosts monthly sound baths.
I'm intuitive with it, and I just facilitate experiences, I guess I would say, you know, of relaxation. And what people experience from there is magic. And I think we just need to, you know, all as human beings be open to more magic.
Mark Anderson, a percussionist and Zen Buddhist priest, realized sound baths offered an accessible way for people to reach a state of mindfulness.
I realized inviting somebody into a sound bath was like way easier than inviting somebody to follow their breath for 45 minutes. And it's an entryway, kind of a doorway into this much bigger understanding of the contemplative mind or contemplative experience.
And while sound baths are in some ways a modern day invention, its roots go back to numerous cultural practices.
Typically, all the instruments you use for that kind of sound making tend to have really long envelopes. They just resonate, and they tend to have really just a really long tail on them.
Think about church bells or the Om sound in Hindu and Buddhist modalities.
When instruments vibrate, they penetrate the body because the body is mostly water and the water conducts vibrational energy easily.
Anderson often hosts sound baths in small studio settings, but he's also hosted larger events at the Cedar Cultural Center in Minneapolis. The first, held on the winter solstice, attracted hundreds of people.
You know, I was hoping to get 120 people or 150 people in the door. And we sold out the room, but we sold out the room like normal seating, which is like 300 people or something. We had to turn people away. And like, I was shocked. The Cedar was shocked.
Since then, they've adjusted how many tickets they sell for the large sound bath events to make sure everyone has room to lie down and get comfy. The most recent winter solstice I attended, featuring singer Natalie Nowitzki, felt like a giant sleepover. The event's popularity shows just how appealing sound baths are right now. After all, most people are overworked, underrested, and overexposed to phone and computer screens. Sound baths offer a break from that, where you lie down and let the healing sound waves over you. For KFAI, I'm Sheila Regan.
You are listening to Miniculture on KFAI. Every other Thursday evening at St. Mark's Cathedral, sound therapist Annie Fitzgerald leads a one-hour meditation using sound. This meditation, called a sound journey, is a type of healing modality that transports a participant to a dreamlike state of vibrational healing. KFAI producer Allison Young took part in a recent sound journey and shares the tingling and tantalizing sounds of this ancient practice.
I'm lying on a yoga mat, along with about a dozen or so other people, our heads nestled comfortably on soft pillows. We're in a circle, tracing a labyrinth painted on the floor. Crystal singing bowls and a velvety voice fill Whipple Chapel at St. Mark's Cathedral in Minneapolis. The room is lit only by candles and the angled rays of sunlight coming through stained glass. I'd heard about sound journeys before, and I was intrigued. It's a practice that uses sound vibrations to enhance well-being, and it's less a musical concert and more of a healing meditation, a kind of sound bath, as singer-songwriter Annie Fitzgerald explains.
When I write a song, there is structure. There's a lyrical structure. There's a structure to the song itself. When I am facilitating sound journeys, I don't necessarily know what I'm going to play. I am literally working with the energy that everyone brings into the room, which is different every single time. It also depends on the energy that's swirling around in the world right now.
Sound has great power to move us. Just think about your favorite songs that might be upbeat or might put you in a more contemplative mood. Certain frequencies and timbres can stir emotions and elicit specific reactions. Recently, scientists have learned that sound can affect our physical bodies as well. Like brainwave entrainment, that's when large-scale electrical oscillations in our bodies naturally synchronize to the rhythm of external stimuli. Even more promising are recent in vitro experiments, where sound has caused resonance inside DNA, and it's brought about healing. For Annie Fitzgerald, her journey has taken her from opera to musical theater to songstress and now a certified sound therapist. Her orchestra of prayer bowls, chimes, shakers, rattles, drums, and gongs serve a dual purpose of relaxation and restoration.
So I use the instruments in very specific ways as an offering in order to help us sort of move and clear energy that isn't serving us, because certain frequencies work with different parts of our body and then to help fill everything back up again.
Some instruments are soothing, like seed pods that sound like frogs, or koshi chimes and flow chimes that feel like a caress on the ear. Other instruments are more intense, like the gong and the ocean drum, a large container filled with pellets that sounds like rain or waves.
Some sounds can sort of make you feel uncomfortable, and it sometimes feels like it's a pressure valve, that it's kind of building, 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 and then there's a pop, but that's literally just the energy that's moving and clearing.
To invite us fully into the space, Fitzgerald asks us to set an intention so that she and everyone in the room can act as witness to our journey. What is special and unique to her practice is not only that she sings, but how she interacts with participants. She stands right over me and strikes a buffalo drum, deep and resonant, and I can feel it in my solar plexus.
My intention when I'm doing it in the beginning is just to connect everyone's hearts, because I'm actually am playing the heartbeat. And so a lot of times I get to see everyone just sort of smile. They sort of just smile and light up a little bit.
Beginning this November, Annie Fitzgerald's sound journey will be part of a new program, a holistic wellness community at St. Mark's. The program will explore multifaceted healing modalities, including yoga, grief circles, somatic practitioners, food as medicine, art therapy, and more. Called the Sanctuary at St. Mark's, their mission is to be, quote, a place for healing the heart of the city in the heart of the city. And of course, Sound Journeys continues at the cathedral every other Thursday.
The Sound Journey meditation can also help anchor in the joy and the love and all of the good things that are going on for people too. So it depends on how you show up.
For KFAI, I'm Allison Young.
Thank you. This is 10,000 Fresh Voices, a project of Miniculture. I'm your host, Erica Janik. Every Tuesday night, Choir Walk With Me gathers to practice. The small group sings a diverse mix of songs and prides itself on celebrating the esoteric and weird. KFAI's Angela Lundberg brings us the story.
It's a Tuesday night and Choir Walk With Me is doing its warm-up vocals. The group's name is a play on the David Lynch film Fire Walk With Me, and they sing all kinds of songs, from classic crooners to indie rock. Choir Walk With Me is a small choir comprised of about 15 singers based out of South Minneapolis. But this is not your average choir. Its oddball songs and diverse members redefine what a choir is expected to sound and be like.
When you motor away beyond the what's your lips, when you free yourself from the chance of a lifetime.
Peter Hogan has led the choir since February 2024. With an extensive musical background, Hogan chooses a unique mix of songs and does all of the arrangements himself.
We sing a wide variety of stuff, going from Dean Martin and Roy Orbison to, we did a Rihanna song last year. We've done Magnetic Fields, Cher, Joanna Newsom, and The Fall. And it's all just stuff that I like. I have kind of eclectic tastes. I take a little bit of input from people, but as we say at the beginning of each season, this is not a democracy, which is funny, sort of, hopefully.
Even if it's not a democracy, so to speak, the choir members definitely have songs they like to perform as a group. Maggie Hogan's favorite song is Masterpiece by Big Thief.
It's one that makes a lot of people cry, but it is just beautiful and it's lovely to sing.
Jane Hornsby also loves Masterpiece and was surprised at how emotional performing can be.
I think there's a spiritual element to it. Like, sometimes art makes us emotional and there's tears and we hug each other, and sometimes it makes us laugh, and we're just kind of together through all of the emotions, and I think that that's really powerful.
On the opposite side of sad, teary ballads, Amy Wilkerson prefers more upbeat songs.
Well, I really liked when we sang Tip City by the Amps, and I like songs that we can scream more and kind of get things out. There's a lot of anxieties in the world now, and it's kind of a therapy.
Wilkerson first joined another choir years ago in the midst of a deep depression, but singing helped her recover.
Oh, I find joy in this choir. It's silly, it's kinky, it's sassy.
The Busted Studs said it was good. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
In addition to the whoops and hollers of songs like Tip City, everyone in Choir Walk With Me agrees that there's something more meaningful at work than just having fun and blowing off steam. This is Jess Buns.
I've had a lot of mental health struggles, and it's been a good place for me to turn when I'm feeling down, and I know that I have people who have my back and love me and like want me to succeed, and singing is just so good for my overall well-being.
But what if you're afraid you can't sing? Director Peter Hogan, who is lovingly nicknamed Choir Daddy, says that doesn't matter.
And I don't really want to audition people. I don't want it based on skill. I want it more based on personality. And if they can sing well, that's a bonus. But I'd rather have people sound a little rough around the edges, but enthusiastic, than super polished and classically trained.
Joining a choir is also a great way to try something new and get out of your comfort zone. Maggie Hogan found a way to do just that.
I decided to join choir because it was a whole new thing for me, and it kind of fires up a whole different side of my brain. I'm used to having very, very sporty type hobbies, and this is just something that allows me to express myself in a whole different way.
Despite having a musical background dating back to childhood, Jane Hornsby says they still struggle with insecurities.
I'm from a very musical family, but I've always been insecure about my own musical abilities. But doing it with a group makes me feel like the stakes are lower and I can have fun with it and just sing, which I really enjoy.
Jess Buns adds,
I consider us a family. I don't know if every choir feels like a family, but this one certainly does, and I'm really grateful for it.
Whenever the choir members part ways after practice or a performance, you could say that reuniting again is often just like they never said goodbye. This is Angela Lundberg for KFAI Radio.
You've been listening to Miniculture on KFAI. Support for Miniculture is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Miniculture tab on kfai.org. This is 10,000 Fresh Voices, a project of Miniculture. I'm your host, Erica Janik. Spending time outdoors is good for us. That's not just common sense. It's been proven again and again by scientific research. And yet, studies show that kids today spend shockingly little time outside. So if nature is so good for children, why aren't they getting more of it? That's where Project Get Outdoors, or Project GO, comes into play. For the past 20 years, Project GO has helped introduce kids to the wonders of the natural world. KFAI's Allison Young went to check it out.
I work with the kindergartners and the fifth graders. And so at the beginning of the year, when I introduce myself, I say, I'm Miss Sarah. I'm with Project Get Outdoors. I'm a naturalist. So I'm a teacher, but I teach out in nature. And then I'll say, what is nature? One year, this kid, he actually raises his hand. He says, nature is joy.
Oh, I love that.
I was like blown away. I didn't even know how to respond to that. I was like, Buddha was sitting there in the class. Wow.
Sarah Holger knows a lot about nature and how nature brings joy, especially to kids. She's a certified naturalist and the founder and program coordinator for Project Get Outdoors. It's a nonprofit that's been connecting young people to the outdoors in Southeast Minnesota for 2 decades. With a focus on underrepresented youth, Project Get Outdoors, or Project GO, runs programs designed to get kids outside.
So there's a lot of ways you can do that. And over the years, our training has expanded from the after-school program setting to now we train therapists, social workers, school counselors on nature-based therapy and ways to work with nature as a partner in healing for youth.
Sarah traces her passion back to a book she read years ago, Richard Louv's Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. Louv makes the case that there's a cost to spending too much time indoors, a cost to attention span, general physical health, and our senses. Time in nature, he argues, is good for kids. It can improve cognitive skills and creativity. And that idea hit a nerve for Sarah.
We were outside all the time as a family. So I was very naive and just assuming like all kids were still going outside. So then reading that book was just a real eye opener for me. Like, no, most kids are not going outside. I couldn't comprehend that.
According to the University of Michigan Institute for Social Research, which conducted a long-term study of children's time use habits, children spend less than 10 minutes a day in unstructured outdoor time. The reasons vary from increased screen time and parental fears about safety and strangers to structured schedules and reduced access to natural areas due to urbanization.
Becoming comfortable in nature is even harder for the children of migrant workers. And so that's where Sarah first put her energies, with a group of children in Plainview, a small town in Wabasha County with a strong migrant population.
Families that come up from Texas to work at Lakeside Canning Factory and then also on local farms. Every year they come back and forth, back and forth. And there was kind of a gap in programming for those children. I was like, well, let's try piloting something and let's make sure it's accessible for these kids that aren't able to be in 4-H and FFA and all the other outdoor type things that other kids might be in.
Sarah went door to door, often with a translator, explaining to parents how time in nature could help their kids. The pilot program took off, and soon other communities wanted in.
With Project Get Outdoors, you were constantly moving. There was just so much going on that actually like made the highlight of my day.
25-year-old Christian Fernandez was one of those early Project Go kids. As a second grader, he admits he could never sit still. But because his mother was finishing college and his father had a demanding job, he rarely spent time out in nature with his family. It was Project Go that introduced him to the wonders of the outdoors and gave him a lifelong hobby.
Looking back at it, I don't know where I would be without fly fishing because I'm totally in love with it.
Now, as an adult who works with young kids, Christian sees firsthand what happens when a child gets his hands dirty.
You know, like when a kid puts a worm on a hook for the first time, it's a little bit of like that surprise. They don't want to touch it. But once they get it on the hook and they cast it and they get their first bite, they get that look on their face, that exciting look like they got a fish on. And you can tell, you know, not only did they hook a fish, but they're hooked on fishing now.
Since 2005, Project Go has served over 50,000 children in more than 50 locations across Minnesota. Their programs have been offered at community centers, YMCAs, Boys and Girls Clubs, recreation centers, libraries, latchkey programs, and low-income housing complexes. And as Sarah points out, the programs can be implemented in nearly any setting, sometimes with the intention of simply allowing for discovery and serendipity.
So we might be going out and we're going to look for rocks and learn about rocks, but that's just kind of the mask for the topic. We get out there and we want to look at deer poop or mushrooms.
We would go behind St. Charles High School in Winona County, and we would go play in the woods that was behind there. And I can't remember which activity we were doing, but I remember we had some free time and people were finding a lot of turkey feathers around, and I couldn't find one. And I remember with like 2 minutes left before we wrapped up, I found one, and it was one of those memories that I'll never forget because I was just so happy to find one.
I mean, we go wherever it ends up, and oftentimes it totally takes us off the topic of what we had planned for the day, but that's success. To me, that's success. That means you did a good job.
For KFAI, I'm Allison Young.
Listening to Mini Culture on KFAI. Support for Mini Culture is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Mini Culture tab on kfai.org.
You have been tuned into Mini Culture Presents here on KFEI. Earlier in today's program, we aired episode 1 of the Mini Culture podcast, now in their 9th season. If you enjoyed this, good news, come on back next week for more of Mini Culture's 2025 year in review and another episode of Mini Culture season 9. If you can't wait for next week, you can, however, enjoy it wherever you enjoy listening to podcasts. It is all over the place in the usual outlets. Support for Mini Culture on KFEI is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. This is Fresh Air Community Radio, KFEI 90.3 FM in the Twin Cities. Support for this program comes from KFEI listener members, just like yourself. Thank you for pitching in. Have a beautiful day, and thanks again for tuning in. Coming up next, The Upside Down.